We have Lindsay Simon from A Balanced Life. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on again, Jen.
Always fun.
Yes.
Educational.
Definitely. Yes, that's what I try to hope to do, is educate the community.
I saw you in the paper.
Oh, yeah? Which one did you see?
I don't know. Well, I don't honestly, I don't pick up the paper that often. It was the Tribune.
Yes.
And, yeah, you had an article in there.
Yep.
Yeah, I like that. I'm like, oh, this is good.
Oh, good. I'm glad you liked it. Yeah, I'm going to be writing another article in the next couple weeks. And then we had another one of our therapists, Mariana Randolph, just wrote
on
grief.
Yep, saw that.
Yep,
the grief. I learned about grief in college. I took a class called Religious Approaches to Death and Dying. Kind of clicked off that sociology box or something. It was my freshman year. And it was an interesting class. How different cultures and religions and whatnot deal with death and grief. And so we got to learn, what was it, Kubler-Ross?
Yep.
And the different stages of grieving and stuff. And those hold true.
Yep.
That's no joke. So anyway, check out the article. It was good.
Yes. So depression, anger, bargaining. No, wait, denial, sorry, anger, bargaining, depression, and then acceptance is kind of the ultimate goal as you work through grief. And the interesting thing about grief is also to know that it's not just related to the end of this physical world, their life.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a divorce, right? The person could still be alive, and you could grieve the loss of the relationship.
Yeah, I had a discussion with someone a few years back on that, where, you know, if you have an absentee parent or where there's loss in your life, it really is kind of the same thing. So very interesting. Also, how people handle grief and moving through that, different rates and different times.
Right, that it looks different to everybody and every single situation. So you might grieve the loss of an uncle differently than the loss of your fertility, because that's one area that people don't talk about a lot, is if a woman is infertile and being able to come to terms with that is a huge loss and grief period. They have to go through the loss of the fantasy and the idea of the family of being able to have their own children. So there's different types of grief, and each person can experience them differently and for different lengths of time. And there's no end, really. There's coming to acceptance, but there's never really going to be a time where you're not missing a piece of your heart because
it's all okay.
Yeah.
You don't get it. Right? And that's interesting. You know, you talk about fertility and stuff, and there's so many, it is just as an example, so many things out there where we do experience loss and we probably don't really deal with it or process it because we don't, you know, nobody died, you know, kind of a
thing.
And I don't know that people recognize, because I've been through a situation in my life where there was a very huge loss, but no one died. And so you don't get that same circle of support, maybe.
Correct.
And it's just been the last year or two that I've kind of processed through that. It seems a little unfair sometimes.
Right. And so the person could be very much alive, and it could be something that maybe is not socially acceptable as something that would lead to grief.
Mm-hmm.
And what we know from the mental health standpoint really is that any kind of loss leads to grief. So if it's the loss of a friendship, and that person could still be here, but maybe you've gone in different directions and they've gone into a different lifestyle, and and that is a loss to grieve. And so it doesn't necessarily have to be the traditional, the loss of a life. And then there's the flip side, where someone might lose somebody but not be grieving that intensely, and then feel guilt or shame about not grieving how they think they should be.
And I think grieving how you should, I think that's so important. I have friends, they lost a child, and they learned a lot going through that grieving process, because each of them grieved completely differently than the other.
Right.
And, you know, learning to be supportive of your partner through that, understanding what may be important to them is not important to you, and vice versa, and how you support that, because everyone's a little different.
Right. So we basically know two general things that are helpful through grief. Or I guess we could say we know what's unhelpful. And what's unhelpful is isolating.
Yeah.
Right? So being able to talk to people and how people talk about things, how people feel about things might be different person by person. But we do know that when we try to shove our feelings away, you know, brush them under the rug, pretend they're not happening, pull our bootstraps up, and you know, those actually create other problems, secondary problems. So when we shove away our emotions and we don't address them, that can cause sleep problems, depression, anxiety, racing thoughts, irritability, anger outbursts, substance use, it could lead to. So shoving it away and pretending it's not there, we know that doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. It doesn't.
Right. And the other thing that is helpful during times of grief is self-care.
Hard one for women.
Yeah, definitely. So, and self-care does not just mean eating right and exercising. Those are two of hundreds of different types of self-care. But there's physical self-care, there's psychological self-care, there's emotional self-care, there's spiritual self-care. And that can look different for anyone. And, you know, we've talked about this before, and I encourage anyone who's curious to know what is self-care and wants to do a little assessment, they go online and just Google self-care assessment PDF. It pops right up, and there's a whole list of a couple hundred different ways of taking care of yourself that you can go through to assess where am I at right now and what are some goals I want to set for myself.
Yeah, I think it's kind of knowing yourself, what works for you.
Right.
Yeah, that's important things. I know we're not talking about grief today.
Right. So we kind of dabbled a little bit on what I was talking about, though, because with grief sometimes comes guilt or shame.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to talk today about specifically shame and being able to know the difference between guilt and shame.
That's a great thing, because I know we had a conversation this week on guilt, and as we celebrate, I don't know if celebrate's the right word, let's, as we remember the Angora fire 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, no celebration going on, but just in memory of what happened, and mm-hmm. you know, fortunately no lives were lost or anything, but people experiencing guilt when their home survived and their neighbors didn't. That was
right.
A huge issue.
And so guilt becomes around a behavior. Your guilt is, I feel bad that my house made it and that yours didn't. And so that could be a motivating. So guilt can be a very healthy emotion, mm-hmm. and very motivating to then go help your neighbor, right?
Yeah.
If that happens. And that might be irrational guilt, because it's not like you caused it or it was intentional. But you might feel some guilt, which could motivate you to actually reach out and help others.
Yeah.
Now, if there were shame around it.
So, like, maybe you threw all your pine needles into their yard next to their house.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I don't think anyone did that. But you had a role, perhaps.
Well, shame comes from the belief that whatever happened, it's related to something, you're a bad person.
Yeah.
So something's wrong with you. You're inadequate. Something's wrong with you. You as a person, versus guilt is about your behavior.
Okay.
So shame is about personality. Guilt is about a person. So if, let's say, you got in a fight with your loved one and you swore at them or name called, and afterwards you withdraw because you feel very ashamed, because you're thinking to yourself, oh, I'm such a bad person. I can't believe I did that. I'm so bad. I don't deserve, this person doesn't deserve to be with me. That, what's wrong with me? That's shame.
Okay.
Because you're interpreting what happened as something's wrong with you. Something's wrong with you as a person, which is unchangeable. There's no hope in shame.
You're just messed up.
Right, exactly. And you can see how that comes a lot when people have mental health disorders, right? They feel shame, like there's no hope, like there's something wrong with me, or I brought this upon myself. If I were a better person, maybe I wouldn't bring this. Maybe it wouldn't, like if I was, so shame has to do with your personality, and it feels very stuck. Now, guilt is about behavior. And that is actually motivating for change. So if you get in a fight with someone, call them an idiot, and afterwards you say, oh, I really regret that I name called. I really regret the behavior of yelling.
Yeah.
I am sorry for yelling. And that must have made you feel scared, angry, sad, how it hurt. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry for that. So see how you can apologize for the behavior? You're not saying I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
You're saying I regret this behavior and I apologize for this behavior.
Uh-huh.
So this is what I'm doing about it. So that comes with hope.
That's, yeah, huge difference in the two.
Right? And so guilt leads to motivation. Shame leads to withdrawal, avoidance, and not dealing with things. It leads to stuckness.
Uh-huh.
And we actually know that shame, when we look at studies about it, is directly linked to substance abuse, anger, domestic violence, depression, anxiety.
Well, that's a messed up thing now, isn't it? That's a whole lot of bad.
Right, because then it leads to what? More shame.
More shame.
Yeah. Right. So there's this stuckness. So what do you think might be the antidote? How do you get out of that? I'm a bad person. Oh, my God.
Come talk to you.
Right. That's definitely one way.
Yeah, I mean, that is because you do get stuck. I mean, I can think of areas in my life where I do have those tracks running.
Yeah.
Where it's like, this is just the way it is because obviously something's wrong with me.
Right. And so one that shows you're not a sociopath. So that's good because
that's good. There's a win.
So shame has a purpose too. It shows us that we have empathy because we care about what other people, you know. But if we have shame, so sociopaths don't have that part of their brain, empathy. So they don't feel shame. So one, that's a good thing that you feel that because it shows you're not a sociopath.
I'll put that in the win column.
That's what we're going for. That's why you see a therapist.
Take what you can get.
Right. So the other thing is sharing your story. So whatever it is about the story that you regret and whatever you're feeling shame about, uh-huh. being able to verbalize it and express it to someone.
Okay.
Who is then able to empathize with your experience is the antidote to shame. Because they cannot exist together. And so this is, for example, when I work with my batterers intervention program, I uh-huh. have the men share their stories of what got them there. And the validation and the empathy of understanding from the other guys in the group lets them move from shame to guilt. Because for them to go into, I am so ashamed of my actions, so I'm not going to talk to anyone. I'm just going to drink because I don't and pretend it didn't go away.
You generally hide it.
Yes.
You hide things you're ashamed of.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the opposite, sharing things, even though it's painful and uncomfortable, is the antidote. It moves you from shame into guilt. So I regret this behavior, and this is what I'm doing about it now.
Yeah.
So shame is essentially, I am bad. Guilt is, my behavior is bad. And that's where change can happen.
Okay.
And that's actually what we want to do in therapy is have people come when they talk about what they're shamed, we help move them into guilt so they can go, my behavior's bad and I can change my behavior.
We're gonna make you feel guilty. But right? No, I mean, that makes sense though, because well, you're stuck otherwise.
Yep.
And if you're not talking about something, I'll tell you straight up, talking to somebody about things. And I will say my shame is not something horrible. I didn't do anything really bad. It's more just a perception of myself than anything. But sharing it, I don't know that I've shared it with, but some of the stuff around or some of the ways I'm feeling, I shared with a friend who is a very close friend of mine, who probably is my best friend. And, you know, really opened up to her a few weeks ago. And here's someone who's one of my best friends I spend a lot of hours with every week. And she didn't realize that I was feeling this way.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, really? Yeah.
Right.
But I've noticed, first of all, I have freedom to talk to her more about what I'm feeling. And I've noticed a change in how she addresses. She's more intuitive to it now. And
empathic and validating.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Because she's a good friend. I mean, she just didn't know.
Right.
Know, you don't know what you don't know. But... so talking is huge.
Definitely. And that's where finding a safe person or safe place to do that is essential and key to moving out of shame. And that's especially hard for men because being vulnerable is seen as being weak. Whereas we know now that that's a myth because it actually causes more problems. By hiding things and not sharing your emotions and what you're experiencing causes more problems. So I'm going to kind of go over the four problem behaviors that come out when we feel shame.
Okay.
All right. So this is when we're not addressing the issue. We're not talking about it to anybody.
It just gets worse.
We just kind of hide it and keep it all inside and just spin in our heads. So one thing that we might see people do is withdraw.
Okay. Yeah.
So that is what we call the classic shame response. So it's feeling rejected and distanced and isolated and withdrawing from connection. You'll see people get really quiet, withdraw into themselves, and essentially what you see is depression.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the next thing you might see, and remember, all these can happen together or alone. So the next unhealthy way to deal with shame would be you might start attacking yourself. So you start having
a lot of ways to do that too,
right? So that's that negative internal critic, negative self-talk inside our head. You're such an idiot. I can't believe you do that. You're so unworthy. You're defective. You're stupid. This kind of negative self-talk, that's attacking in your internal self because of shame that's not being addressed.
Can you attack yourself in a physical way? I mean, we talk about substance abuse, drinking, overeating. I mean, things that I know cutting has become a thing with younger girls primarily.
Yes. So, and that actually kind of goes more into the next one, which is avoidance.
Okay.
Because, for example, cutting and drinking and those things, you're doing something else to avoid feeling the pain of shame.
So you're inflicting kind of, well, with drug, I guess that would kind of make, I don't know, I've never done drugs. Thank you. I have two wins this morning. I'm not a sociopath and I don't do drugs. It's a
double win. Those are two great wins.
For me, yeah.
They're huge wins.
Exactly, exactly. But it is, some of those kind of mask the pain where others maybe transfer the pain.
Exactly.
Okay.
So the if you can think of attacking self is internalizing the pain. And it causes, you know, feelings of loneliness and more depression.
Yep.
And so avoidance is strategies. You're trying to turn off the bad feelings. You're avoiding them completely. So you're just replacing other things to do, like addictions, drinking, drug use, overeating, compulsive spending, overworking, overgiving, kind of over putting energy into school. But yes, that would also be with the self-harming. You're actually giving your brain something else to do because self-harming actually changes your brain. It releases endorphins similar to drugs do.
Okay.
So it's
kind of does both things.
Because one, yeah, because you actually get to inflict pain, but then once it releases the endorphins, you become addicted to that, the relief of not feeling the shame because your body, you have released endorphins. And so again, it's an avoidance strategy. And when we avoid things, what happens to the problems when we avoid them?
Well, they certainly don't go away. It's a nice theory.
Right.
Just ignore it. It'll go away. But they tend to just kind of, I think when you're internalizing things in your mind, they grow.
Right.
I mean, it becomes habit. It becomes who you are.
Right. It festers.
Yeah.
I'd say when we avoid things, festers, and we avoid shame, it festers.
Yeah, that's not a good word.
Yeah. And we want to, and what therapy essentially is like, if shame is a wound, then it, and you ignore it, it festers and blisters and gets infected. What therapy is we actually clean out the wound, we sew it up properly, that's doing the work, and then we put, you know, antibiotic on it and wrap it up. And that's the whole process of therapy. You know, the cleaning out of the wound is painful at first.
Sure.
But afterwards, instead of that wound, you have healthy scar tissue.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this before, I believe. And so scar tissue is stronger than all the other tissue in the rest of your body.
Yep.
So once you actually address the shame and the experience that has led you to feeling shame and move into guilt and change, do behavior change, talk to somebody, reach out, see what can be done, then you can, that is part of the healing process. And then once you have scar tissue, you're actually stronger for having gone through that.
That is good information. Mm-hmm. And that is, it is, you know, you're right, where you do the initial talking about it, just like cleaning a wound, is painful.
Yep.
It's sad. There's tears. There's, you know, and then, but it is, it becomes a good thing where you can start to heal.
Right. And once you're healed and on the other side, it feels so much better.
Yeah. That is so true. You never know until you have like an injury. I have a little injury from Friday, and mm-hmm. you take for granted feeling good sometimes, and then yeah. when, you know, you get that pain. You talk about endorphins. I'm like, yeah, why am I running when this hurts? I'm being careful, but it is, there is an endorphin piece of it through the pain.
Right, and so you also become used to suffering. So there's just
that's me.
Right? So when you're doing these kind of, what we call like self-destructive patterns, if you're for just kind of constantly feeling this low level of shame and feeling bad about yourself and doing these bad behaviors, it's just kind of like a level 3 constantly, you know, feeling bad. But you just, yeah. that becomes your norm, that you don't even realize that there's a level 0 or 1 out there on the other side. If you do the work, you might have to go up to, and so when I see these numbers, like we do a scale 0 to 10, how angry do you feel, you know, 10 being the most angry and 0 being not angry at all, but we can see how much shame do you feel. You know, if you're like at a constant 3 or 4, you just become used to that, living kind of miserably, and then it might be because you think you deserve it.
Yeah.
Which, again, nobody deserves that. Everybody deserves the right to be happy.
Yep.
They do. It doesn't matter what you've been through.
That's right. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Right? Thank you, Jen. Way to bring that in. Someone paid attention in high school.
I tried.
So okay, there's a 4th defense mechanism way that we deal with shame, or I guess don't deal with shame. But way that we kind of deal with that, that's unhealthy, and that is attacking others.
Yep.
So in an attempt to immediately prove that we are more powerful, bigger, stronger, meaner than someone, we can diminish someone else so we can try to feel better about ourselves, and reduce our own shame. We use insults, abuse, violence, and cruelty, and by doing that, we feel power. However, what does that do to our shame?
Increases it.
Yep. Exactly. Because afterwards, we then feel shame about the dishonorable behaviors. And those are the bullies, right? And so it feeds into low self-esteem on a bigger picture and more shame, which will lead to more avoidance behaviors, more attacking of self, more withdrawal, more depression later on. And in the moment, short term. So all of these things people do in the short term because there's some relief, but they all cause long-term bigger problems.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I'm sitting here listening to this. It's like, well, gee, I could start working on these different things, but then I wonder if I'd be mad at myself that I didn't do it sooner and I wasted all those years.
Oh, so this is where I appreciate you bringing that up, because I'm sure you're not the only person who thought that.
Isn't that a silly thing to think? But I'm like, I wonder if I would, like, it would fix everything. Not everything. Nothing fixes everything, but fix things, and it would be like, oh, okay, this problem's done. And
well, I often get people in therapy who are like, oh, why didn't I do this earlier? Or like, oh my God, or this has been the best thing that's happened to me. You know, they have these, oh my, epiphanies, and oh my God. And then I say, well, you weren't ready. You know, you had to go through what you had to go through to get to here. And that's where we can use our mindfulness skills of just non-judgmentally accepting where you're at right now without any judgment.
And you know, and that is, you have to, I can be really judgy with myself,
mm-hmm.
especially, and it is, I, you know, I told somebody that, you know, I run really early in the morning, and I do that for a couple reasons. One, when I say early in the morning, I mean like real, like when people are going to bed early, probably really early in the morning, like dark early. And part of it's my schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it's my schedule. The other part is, I don't want anyone to see how bad I do it. I mean, I use the term very loosely when I say, at least the little Fitbits finally recognize that I'm actually running. That was a big triumph. But, I, you know, I had to give myself a little bit of a break, because I do play this track like, oh, you're not good enough. You don't do this well enough. You don't blah, blah, blah. And we've talked before about how I get paralyzing thoughts.
Right.
Where if I can't be perfect and do it well, I don't do it at all.
Right.
And that's, I used to run marathons.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally came to myself last week, prior to getting hurt, although I didn't get hurt running, but prior to that, and said, you know, give yourself a little bit of a break here. You're 10 years older than when you were doing this before.
Right.
You're 60 pounds heavier. Mm-hmm. I've had 2 surgeries since then. I mean, you know what? So the fact that I'm out there doing anything is good.
Right.
I don't need to be ashamed of how I look or what, you know, that I'm not fast enough or sleek enough or, you know, my Lululemons don't fit or whatever it is.
Right.
It's you know, I'm out there doing it.
And so this is the little trick we had talked about before, changing your should statements in your head. I should be able to do this. I shouldn't look like this. I should be faster, whatever it is. Those are all self-judgment statements based on shame.
Yeah.
Right?
Shame and how, you know, that I let myself slide so far. Mm-hmm. Shame and being lazy. Shame, you know. But you're right. You have to come to a point. That's one thing I've noticed in my own life is that I've done things in life, and I'm like, why didn't I do this before? Why? Right. And I don't know. I really don't know the answer, but there is something that happens in your head that says, okay, the time is now, and you can actually move forward and do it. I haven't figured out what that is that clicks on, but I've had definite times in my life, and I know leading up to it, it's like, why can't I just do this? Why can't I just do this? And then all of a sudden, the moment comes, and it's like, I can do it. Nothing changed.
Right. Well, some internal kind of emotional motivation progress. We call it the stages of change that you go through. And, you know, I remember I had a friend who put a Facebook post on it said, you're exactly where you need to be. And I thought, yeah, that's great.
That's good. So although that could make me sad.
So, and where do I want to go to?
Where I need to be right now.
And
how
so,
about tomorrow?
So if we're gonna switch the should statements, out of shame into an action, it would be preferable if. So we've talked about this.
I use that a lot.
Yeah. So I should be able to run this in 10 minutes, whatever it is. it'd be preferable if I was in shape enough to run this 10 minutes. However, I'm not. I can't change the past. It is what it is. So I'm going to meet myself where I'm at and work from here and move forward.
Yep.
So that's just accepting.
And it's hard to get there when you are coming from shame.
Yep.
You know, and I use this one area. I know people probably wrestle with larger shame issues than that, but in more devastating situations, but it is a process to get there,
right?
And you can't just like snap yourself out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where having that person, having a therapist to talk to.
Yeah,
I mean, I look at how long it took me to confide some stuff to my best friend and say, you know, this is where I'm struggling right now, this is how I'm feeling right now.
Right.
And this was not like a new best friend. This is someone who's been in my life for, you know, decades now, and it's to say that. And
right.
But it does move you once you do
yes.
that.
Yeah. So getting out of the stuckness. Again, shame equals stuckness. It's there's something wrong with me. I'm not good enough. I'm flawed. So there's no hope. We want to get into action. And going to a therapist is a great way, especially if, I mean, you know, for men who don't feel as comfortable talking with their friends about emotions and things that they feel ashamed about, that talking with a trained professional who has confidentiality legally and cannot share what you are sharing, but can help reflect a more realistic viewpoint back to you and empathy and understanding, because all people are human and all humans react similarly in situations. So shame is a very human response, and to be have someone just reflect and go, yeah, that's normal. Yeah, of course you'd feel like that. Yeah, that makes sense. Oh my gosh, that feels so relieving. And then you can start moving forward. Once we get out of that shame and come into acceptance and kindness to ourselves, empathy to ourselves, then we can go into forward movement. And then again, your therapist or friend or yourself can help. What's my plan of action? What are my goals to move forward?
Yeah, that is important. you know, you talk about men and not, you know, they don't want to seem vulnerable. I think women fall into a perfection category where we don't admit what, where we're having areas where we're ashamed because it's like, well, we don't want anyone to know that we're less than perfect.
I mean, you nailed it. So the research actually on shame shows that men have difficulty with being vulnerable because they feel they don't want to be weak. Whereas in reality, we know being vulnerable is actually a strength. It strengthens your relationships. Being able to ask for help prevents all these other problems from happening. It's uncomfortable in the moment, but it is actually a great strength to be able to ask for help. And we know that from lots of research to know what helps children grow up to be the healthiest kids is parents who can ask for help. Kids who are taught to ask for help, they actually flourish the greatest. So it's a strength. For women, all of their shame is not all of it, but a lot of shame is around not being able to do it all. They're supposed to be able to clean the house, raise the kids, be the perfect wife, be sexually attractive, be in shape. You know, they're supposed to be this image.
Yeah. And then you've added on perfection. In the last decades, work full time.
Work full time. On top of that.
Be successful in your career.
And then if they are not anything but all of those things, they feel shame.
Yeah.
So again, this is going, and I, you know, this is where oftentimes postpartum depression will come into play because a mom thinks it's supposed to be perfect and they can do it all and still work and have a new baby and be able to be the perfect wife and no.
And not sleep while you're doing all that.
Yes, that is not likely.
Yeah.
And to be able to just have someone to reflect to you, talk to other moms who've been through it, go online and go to other postpartum depression boards and you'll see that the amount of feeling overwhelmed and feeling this, it's this image of not being able to be do it all.
Yeah.
And that's an unrealistic expectation.
Yeah, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll last for many years.
Unless you go get help from a therapist.
At least when they're babies, you can pick them up and move them.
So different complications at different stages of life.
That's the truth. Yeah, it is, I think, important, you know, to talk to people because we do spend a lot of time. I'm a firm believer a lot of our issues in our society stem from unaddressed mental health issues, whether it's a diagnosed mental health thing or if you're wrestling with shame.
Right.
Things that have happened in your past. You know, there's a lot of discussion on shame that's out of your control. I mean, you talk about perhaps, you know, girls that were victims of rape or that kind of thing. Nothing, you know, certainly not their fault at all, but they carry that shame with them.
Right. And so we want to move into bad things happen to good people.
Yeah.
Rather than, because shame comes from this idea that bad things happen to people who deserve it. And that's a false belief.
Yeah.
Right? So, and also, good people behave badly.
Yep.
And so being able to get to that place in your life where you know you are a good person, maybe something bad happened to you, or maybe you acted badly.
Yeah.
That's different than I am bad.
Yeah.
So we want to keep in that I am good, I acted badly.
And that's, you know, I think important raising kids too. I've always tried to be really cognizant of that because I've somewhere along the line learned that, you know, to differentiate between you're a bad person and your behavior was a bad choice.
Right. How important to teach kids that.
And to really in disciplining and understanding that, you know, making sure I made that clear to my kids. Yeah, you're going to have a consequence. Yeah, you're in trouble. But you're not a bad person. This choice was not a good choice. You made a poor choice. Your behavior is what I'm upset with. Because there is nothing you can do to make me love you more or less. I mean, that you're my baby. It's not going to change ever.
Right.
Yeah, I'm a little one. Well, what if I kill someone? Still love you.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'll come visit you at the jail. But it's really, that is important to understand.
Yep.
That there is a difference between being a bad person and a bad decision.
Right.
And I guess there are some bad people out there. But
well, and typically when we think of who are, you know, bad people, we think of sociopaths. And those are people who actually have their brains do not have the ability to have empathy. When we do brain scans, that literally the part of their brain that demonstrates empathy for others is way understimulated and smaller. So they actually have a brain disorder.
So it's like a neurological disorder.
Yes.
Interesting.
So antisocial personality disorder is thought of as their empathy part of their brain is actually not the same size as other people's, does not work like other people's. So they lack the ability to have empathy. And then if they, so there are people who lack that ability to have empathy that don't end up hurting others, but they grew up in a loving environment. And so they're just kind of very neutral people who don't have a lot of friends and the kind of like people in the basement that, you know, they just, cause they just don't have any feelings towards other people, empathy. But if you have someone who doesn't have empathy for others, the ability to understand what others are going through, plus was in an abusive environment, there's very high chance of them ending up in jail, because then they're going to act violently and not care about what their violent actions do to other people.
Yeah, that, now it's interesting. So we talk about that area of the brain not being like other, you know, the baseline normal, I guess. Is that would be something they're born that way, or can that be influenced through development?
It both. You're okay. Right. So there is a very large genetic. It's like 50-50, okay. Like large genetic, and then it can be trauma influenced as well, because if that's the part of their brain that starts to around what you teach empathy around 3 to 5, developmentally, and if a child has been through significant trauma during that time, that could impact their growth as well. They're part of that brain as well.
Interesting. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Those first 5 years.
Yeah.
Be careful.
And even more, the first 2 years are extremely important in terms of attachment and a child's ability to bond to other people. So, you know, we know that if they're exposed to trauma in those first 2 years, it's much more significant problems later on in life than if they're exposed at 5 or 6.
Yeah, very interesting stuff. I mean, it's just, it's so sad how we can screw things up so badly.
I know. I always have my theory that if everyone could just take a parenting test before becoming a parent, I think it would help out of things. Maybe parenting class.
Yeah, my daughter wrote a paper that everyone should get a license. She's like, you got to get a license to cut someone's hair.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think you even have to have a little license to groom a dog or something.
I know. There's probably a bunch of people politically upset right now by this conversation, but I personally would be on board for licensing people to be parents.
You would know. Of course, you might be out of business.
Unless I become the licensing agency.
There you go. switch gears. I always thought maybe we should hand out, the divorce lawyer, hand out cards at weddings. But it's a good point. I mean, there's so influential those years.
Yep.
And the damage that we do to our kids is probably related to the fact that we didn't deal with things like shame.
Right.
On that side. So, you know.
Because then we try to work out our own issues on our kids. Yeah. And that doesn't help either.
Yeah, they're not little mini therapists.
They're not little mini yous.
Yeah. Say what you might, but
what I wish I had done was soccer and this. You know, each kid is your own person, and you got to figure out what their strengths are.
And that's hard, mm-hmm. I think, because we naturally lean toward pushing our kids toward what we know.
Yeah,
and that's tough. And I think we also, I know I fall fault. You know, I know what didn't work and what was wrong and what would have been better. And I really pushed my kids to not make those mistakes or not. Mm-hmm. You know, to do better or, you know, do this, because this would have, if I had done this, it would have changed this or, and they're not me.
Right.
And it's not, you know, I'm 30 plus years removed from what they're, you know, that age that they're going through. And it's so totally different context. It's hard.
Right. And I encourage parents to educate themselves. That's the antidote to that, to maybe uncertainty of what are the kids going through, what is in their best interest, that there's so much research out there now that shows, and this doesn't mean you have to be perfect parents. This is just gain some knowledge. But for example, we know that kids who don't do anything and isolate, this is pretty black and white, get more depressed.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So you want them to do something. But if you have one of those kids who is like, no, 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 you you know, no, that's something you can know as a parent. You have to do something.
Yeah.
You can try these 25 different things, you know, art, horseback riding, soccer, rock climbing, Boy Scouts, whatever it is. You got to do something, though. And so you can have kind of a general, like, you got to do something, but then give them lots of options to try.
And that's something I know with dads that can get really hard with their boys if they're not necessarily sports inclined, because not everybody is.
Right.
Not all boys are going to be, you know, star of the football team.
Right.
Or want to be star of the football team.
Right.
And I know that I've seen a lot of...
Because that comes with its own levels of responsibility, right?
I've seen
pressure.
Some battles.
Yeah.
With dads and sons and that, you know, specifically. And then moms, you know, want their daughter to be, you know, that great dancer or the cheerleader or the... And I know I'm totally generalizing and stereotyping here, but you know, there's true. Stereotypes come from a reason.
Yeah.
Because they happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard. And again, a lot of it comes from our own inadequacies.
Exactly. And so as a parent, working on yourself will help you be a better parent. It's not selfish. That's the other thing that parents have difficulty with is, you know, prioritizing themselves.
Yeah.
Because you got to remember that if you are not up and running and functioning, you can't help your family to the best.
That's true. Yeah, that is such an important thing to remember. And, you know, if you're dealing with shame, whatever it might be, hopefully there's not a body hidden anywhere. But,
and if so, your therapist actually legally can't share anything if you did a crime in the past. But if you're going to go do a crime, you have to say something.
You can prevent crime. You just
I can't
fix past
crime. Yeah, so your therapist, just remember, what is the HBO show with the mob?
Sopranos?
Sopranos. Okay, he goes and shares all of the people he killed and everything. She literally legally can't share. So,
oh, my gosh.
Even if you have killed someone,
so
you can talk to a therapist.
If he said, I'm ordering a hit on so-and-so, then
but
she could.
She would have to.
But to say 10 years ago, I buried this guy in cement over here. Like, oh, great.
Yep. You're like, okay, let's work through this shame.
Go, la, 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 la. I don't know.
How do we work into guilt for this one? Do you regret that? Or are you a sociopath?
I think that was kind of the gist of the show.
Yes.
That's a great show. Those are interesting issues. And that is good to point out that, you know, you are someone that people can come talk to and not feel like it's, you know securely it's not going to be broadcast to the world or to the authorities or to your spouse. Or
right. And if you can even think of, if someone has seen The Sopranos, Tony Soprano, a lot of his acting out was typically around things he had shame about. When he cheated on his wife or when he hurt a friend or did something, then he would act out towards others. So he was more of a attack other kind of person.
Definitely.
And then he was not dealing with his own shame.
Yeah.
So it can be worked through, is the thing. There's hope in that, talking to someone and getting to the point of empathy. Getting empathy from others, understanding from others, is the antidote to shame. It can move you out of shame and heal shame and dissolve shame. However, that can't happen unless you verbalize it.
Yeah, you got to share it.
Yes.
You got to share it.
As long as you keep it inside you, it will fester.
Definitely. Well, these are important things. I love that we brought the Sopranos into it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we'll never really know what happened to Tony Soprano because we lost James Gandolfini, and I don't think anyone else could play him.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it is good. And I just want to also point out that his therapist had a therapist.
Yes. So. All therapists should have a therapist. That's my one time I'll use a should.
Oh, yeah.
All right. No, it would be preferable. If all therapists had a therapist.
Because I imagine you do carry a lot when you hear things, you know, hopefully not a lot of mob activity going on, but I don't know. I don't know what you hear, but.
Yes. No, I definitely have multiple. I have a Reiki therapist. I have a mental health therapist. You know, I encourage everybody.
Have therapists.
It changes your life. The amount of growth you can do personally, and there's a lot of secondary trauma in a lot of people's work, nurses, doctors, you know, all these people are hearing other people's traumas. They need their own therapy because that's not healthy for them to carry on what we call secondary trauma, other people's trauma.
Yeah, and it is. It's a lot, you know, and if you think you're carrying around something that's so shameful, you can't talk to anybody. I remember a friend of mine who's a pastor telling me I was sharing some, you know, going through a bad spot in my life, sharing and stuff. And I mean, to me, it was like the worst thing in the world. How could this be worse, you know? And he just, you know, kind of shook his head, not to make light of what I was experiencing. And he's like, this is nothing compared to what I hear.
Right.
So if you, you know, if you're carrying something, don't think that it's, you know, it's natural to feel like it's bad and no one else has this and it, you know, everything is horrible. Not to make it better, to say, well, there's a lot worse, but don't feel locked in by that.
Right. That, and you know, the amount of relief that can happen by sharing your story is so worth it. And you are worth it. Each one of you is worth it. Each one of you is a good person who maybe something bad happened to, or a good person who maybe behaved badly. But all of that's workable. And you can work in the here and now towards living a life according to your values. And that's really what it is to how do we reach peace, fulfillment, happiness? And that's through addressing and talking about things you feel shame about, to let them go and work through it.
Yeah. Brushing things under the rug, never good for a lot of reasons, whether it just becomes a recurring problem or comes back to haunt you.
Yep.
They'll pop out.
And I think anyone listening can think of, in a relationship, any how that works, shoving things under the rug, brushing them away. Everyone can follow it through. At some point in their life has had some relationship where then it came out.
Yeah, how'd that work out?
Right. That's called resentment.
Yeah. No, it's cool. Well, people can get a hold of you. You guys have got a beautiful office with lots of different therapists.
Yes, we do. So our office is, our company is A Balanced Life, and you can go online to abalancedlifetahoe.com, and you can look up the different providers we have and services there. We have a contact page where you can email us right through our website. And then our phone number, if you want to call our office, we have the motto that is, if we can't help you, we'll find out who can. And so if you call and talk to us about what your situation is, we will work with you to either have one of our therapists help you or find another agency in town that is a better fit for what you're looking for and what your situation is. The phone number is 530-544-1748. Again, that's 530-544-1748. And then always our website, abalancedlifetahoe.com. And remember to put the abalancedlifetahoe.com, and you can contact us through that.
Very good. And I love all your Facebook posts, Steph.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, check out our Facebook. I always post throughout the week different tools to use and implement based on life and mindfulness and from Psychology Today, and they're all my favorite articles. That's what I do for fun. I read articles on mental health. So,
well, then that's good. Then you're in the right profession.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's very.
If you were like, oh, I got to read this.
Yeah. No, I get excited to go to the gym with my Psychology Today and
check it all out. Yeah. It's good stuff. All kinds of. You know, I was in an office and there's like Bipolar Today. There's crazy magazines out there. I was like, whoa, who knew?
Uh huh. Yeah. So but, if you even just want to walk in our office, we're at 2100 Eloise. And we have like all of these different resources and everything for people. Well, if you prefer talking to someone in person, just walk on in. We're there.
The squishy brains.
Yep. Yeah, squishy. That's thanks to NAMI, that Jeannie, our NAMI representative, brings of those course. For us.
Squishy brains.
Yes.
Fun stuff. Well, we always appreciate you coming here and sharing your wisdom once a month. And,
thank you, Jen.
And it is important. Take care of your mind.
Yes.
It's so huge. I think it's sometimes more important than even your body.
Well, it's part of your body, and it's one of the most important parts of your body.
Your mind's not working.
Right.
You're going to watch bad things happen to your body.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can physically train, but that doesn't fix your head.
Right.
It helps it sometimes.
It can help, because it's a mind-body connection.
But
it helps, but we need mental health.
Yeah, don't use exercise to just disguise another covering thing. We're just
right, it could be an avoidance behavior if it becomes obsessive. Everything in moderation.
Yeah, I've been there, done that too. Yeah. Good thing I'm going to come see you later.
Yes.
Lindsay, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me, Jen.
Lindsay Simon with A Balanced Life Tahoe. Check them out at abalancedlifetahoe.com or on Facebook. It is 10:06, 6 minutes after 10 o'clock. You're listening to K-Tahoe, the new 96.1 and AM 590.